start this one.
Awesome.
I'm starting ready.
Just by way of introduction, Rabbi Blass has been incredibly beyond helpful is not the word, ensuring that and making sure that this Yom Iyun, Shacharis, everything about this day was going to take place and done in the right way. B'derech HaYeshiva, I have a personal sense of gratitude to Rabbi Blass for all of his help on a personal level, but you know, he deserves a very, very widespread Yashar Koach and thank you. Without further ado, Rabbi Blass, thank you.
Just before, as Jacob's taking pictures, I will just mention the time already is late and we have very little time, but really one of the wonderful things that working in YU, I mean, really most things about it, not all things, are great. One of them is to be surrounded by people like Jacob and like many others who have a real sense of idealism, a real sense of service, of being involved, of not looking to complain or be small, but trying to do great things for the yeshiva and for the world. And that's something really that rests on the shoulders of every person, of how can we create more meaning in the yeshiva? How can we be part of a trajectory of Klal Yisrael? How can we be ambitious and trying to be idealistic to help the world? And that's something that not just to get essentially lost in the what's necessary, but sometimes the smallness of I'll get this job and I'll buy this house and I'll do X, Y, and Z, but just you know, why are we here and where are we going and how do I contribute to that? And Jacob's a great example of that among many other guys in YU as well, and we should continue to have programs like this. I want to discuss really just for a few minutes. We only have about 25 minutes, a half an hour. Just a snapshot of a period of time that really resonates, boldly resonates to this day. And before I discuss that snapshot of that period of time, discuss a little bit two images that I'm sure that many of you before have thought about. But two images that the contrast of those two images is beyond deeply unsettling. It's something that a sensitive soul would be, I guess, brought to tears over the contrast of those images. And at least for me, the contrast is the following. And if we think about all the Gemaras and Ksuvos, Gemaras I'm sure everyone here is familiar with, the Midrashim, the Sifrei, the Tanchumam, Gemaras that describe the idea that if a person lives in a Kadosh Baruch Hu, they have a Kadosh Baruch Hu in their life. If you don't live in Eretz Yisrael, you don't have a Kadosh Baruch Hu in your life. If you live in Chutz La'aretz, the way that I guess all of us do, at least for now, it's as though you're being obeyed of Avodah Zarah. The Gemara that tells us, again in Ksuvos, in Midrashim, that a person who lives in Eretz Yisrael is considered to be automatically a Ben Olam Haba. Person lives in Eretz Yisrael is mechaper on them. The Sifrei, quoted famously by the Ramban, and the Ramban holds this way, that all mitzvos and chutz la'aretz are only mitzvos de Rabbanan, but to really fulfill the mitzvah de Raisa, you have to live in Eretz Yisrael. So all of those Mamari Chazal and others, so they paint a picture of not just Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, which definitely is true, but a sense that Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be the place of the ideal Jewish life, ideally connecting to Ribono Shel Olam, an idealized sense of what Klal Yisrael would look like. And that's what Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be. Eretz Yisrael is supposed to be a place where you feel the power of the Kahal, you feel the power, again, of Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. It's supposed to be a place of Shalom, obviously, in the way that Eretz Yisrael, according to the Ramban, mirrors after the setup of the Mishkan and of the Mikdash. And of course, we know the Mishkan with the images of the Kruvim, it's a place of Shalom, Shalom of Klal Yisrael, Shalom of feeling Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence there. And Eretz Yisrael, of course, should be no different. And that image, which I believe all of us are passionate about, and it doesn't make a difference who you are and what kind of yarmulke you wear, or even if you wear a yarmulke, or who you are, but that's just, it's Marei Chazal. It's not Hashkafa, it's not, this is just what we believe in. So contrast that with the image, I almost don't even want to speak about this thing publicly, that goes on today in Eretz Yisrael, and if you want to, you can go on the blogs and find plenty of stories like this. My brother lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and he was driving a few years ago with his family, and they have, they're one of sort of these typical, I guess, weird, frum YU type families, where you don't really know where you belong in the world, you don't really know who you are, you sort of feel like you're part of the yeshiva world, but you're also very Zionistic, sort of like there are thousands of people out there that if you ask them who they are and with whom they identify, they'll just probably either ignore the question or give a little shrug. Or so they were driving about Beit Shemesh, and they have like a flag on their car. And they were going down the road towards Beit Shemesh, and they had to pass through a Beit Shemesh bays. And when they got to a stop sign or to a light, there was like a fire in the middle of the street, and the car had to stop. And someone came over, my nephews, you know, 6, 7, 8, 19 years old in the car, and they ripped off the Israeli flag from the car, and they threw it into the fire, and they pounded on the car, and obviously, besides anything else, my nephews were just devastated by that imagery. But unfortunately, it's an image that you can find taking place out there in Eretz Yisrael. The question is, like, how did we get there? How did we get to that point where even such feelings exist? The person lives recently, I know, speaking of others, they just came back from Reish Yerushalayim recently, and you drive through the streets of Beit Shemesh this year with the posters about the elections that are taking place, and people have any sensitivity towards the animosity, the animus that lives in Eretz Yisrael. How exactly did we get to that point? So one answer, it's not necessarily an answer, but clearly one reason for the conflict, but I'm not sure the major reason for the conflict, can be found, of course, even in the discussion of the Rishonim, the discussion of the Acharonim. It really focuses around the Megillas Esther, who's the commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvot. I'm sure it's Megillas Esther that everyone here is familiar with, but just mention it very, very briefly. We know that the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvot, the Rambam was a real maverick in establishing a Sefer HaMitzvot. The Gemara tells us the Yad HaMakos are 613 mitzvot. That's where we know the idea of 613. But really, until the time of the Rishonim, I mean, the late Gaonim, the Rebbe Sajigo and the Hag and others, people didn't really codify exactly what those mitzvot were. And the Rambam, of course, codified the mitzvot in the Sefer HaMitzvot, mitzvah say, mitzvah lo say. And part of, there is almost like a cottage industry of those people who comment, what did the Rambam include that he should not have included? What did the Rambam not include? And why did the Rambam say this and not say that? And many, many Sarmarin since then, including the Ramban himself, were commented on the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvot. And we know, of course, the Rambam, again, Dvarim Yaduim, the Rambam left out the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And there's been a lot of discussion why it is. Now, the most popular answer, anybody even know the most popular reason why it is the Rambam excluded Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? The most popular answer, not the most famous answer, but the most popular answer, so one answer is discussed by Moshe Feinstein and others, that the Rambam believes, and others believes, that it's not a mitzvah saseh, right? But it's just a key mitzvah, something that you fulfill if you go there, you've been mekayim the mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, but it's not a mitzvah chiyuvis, the way the Ramban obviously says that it is. That's one answer given. The most popular answer, famous popular answer, is an answer given by even the Rishonim, the Rivash, and others, that namely say that it's really a technical issue within the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvos. That if the Rambam is not going to include two mitzvos, where one mitzvah already is obvious, right? If mitzvah A, if there's mitzvah B, and it's obvious within mitzvah B that you have to do A, the Rambam's not going to include both A and B. And the Rambam says this explicitly in his introduction to the Sefer HaMitzvos. And therefore, some people, or many people, what they claim is that the Rambam believed that obviously there's an obligation to go ahead and to wipe out the Shiva Ambim in Eretz Yisrael and other mitzvahs that are dependent on living in Eretz Yisrael. And that's a technical reason why the Rambam does not include the mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because it should be obvious from the other mitzvahs, in which case even the Rambam would seem to agree with the Ramban that the mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, of course, the answer that has garnered the most attention, as I said before, is the answer that Megillas Esther and Megillas Esther, and the Satmar Rebbe, and the Minchas Olazar, the Munkach, and many other Svarim as well. Of course, they pick up on the Gemara about the Shalosh Shavuos, the Gemara and Ksuvos, the Loyala Bechoma, that we cannot go ahead and sort of come back en masse and force and settle the land of Israel. And that's with a state or without a state, or right, we can't go ahead and sell the land of Israel. And in fact, it's inappropriate to do so. It's rejecting the very nature of the galus that we're in. And that was sort of the very, very strongly, I guess, anti-Zionistic statement. And that, of course, has become popularized in Hasidic circles. That doesn't totally explain, or really explain, even though it might be true, and many people do believe that, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue of exactly this conflict. Because there are many people that don't hold by that sheet of Megillas Esther. And this, that's to some degree a radical shita. It's a radical reading of the Rambam. What might be really much more apropos to this issue, although again, that first issue in the Rambam certainly is something that is discussed as well. And clearly, the issue and the conflict can really best be seen in a few year period, let's say between 1919 and 1925 in Eretz Yisrael. And of course, that revolved around the life of, and I guess the career of, the role of Rav Kook in Eretz Yisrael. And let's go back a little bit and speak about Rav Kook. I'm by no means an expert. If anybody here is a bucky in history, everything I'm going to say is well known and is obvious. But for those perhaps who are not aware of the time, I'll mention a little bit about the life of Rav Kook and about those issues. Rav Kook, and every book says this about every gadol personality, he was a genius. Okay? Not everyone was a genius. Not every person was, you know, finished shots by, you know, 4 or 5 years old. But what's clear, according to everyone's statements, and this includes all the gadolim in Europe, this already when Rav Kook was older, Rav Chaim Moser and Rav Zalman Meltzer and on and on, Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, but even when Rav Kook was young, was that he was just like a very rare child. He was a rare child because of his genius and his ability in learning, but he was maybe even more rare because there was just, as was described by many of the Gedolim of that generation, there was a certain spirit about him. There was a certain almost like holiness, even as a young person. And even as like a 15, 16-year-old, you know, Gedolim throughout Europe were running after Rav Kook to go ahead and that they should marry his daughter. There's a statement which is attributed to the Nitziv. It's hard to know whether these things are always accurate or not, but the Rav Kook was engaged to the daughter of the Teumim. And before they got married, he wanted to go study in Volozhin. And he was only formally in yeshiva. He was one of these kids. There's many people like this. You can't really put him in yeshiva. And if you're a real genius, I don't know if any of you have this malady, it's very hard to sort of sit in yeshiva. So his father always trained him privately, always learned b'chavrusa. But he went when he was a couple years younger than you to Volozhin. The Nitziv said it would have been worth having Volozhin open just for Rav Kook. Right? And think about who was in Volozhin during that 100-year period, but it was worth having Volozhin open just for Rav Kook. And that's the way that he was thought of. And at a very, very young age, 22, 23, 24, 25, he was given positions in the rabbinate already in Eastern Europe, in Lithuania, and Russia. And eventually, in 1904, a position opened to be the Rav of Yafo. If you read through Rav Kook's writings, which, speaking to Shui before, people have read any of Rav Kook, again, it's an overflowing spirit. It's just this. It's very, very unique. The Hebrew often is very, very difficult. It comes from a poetic spirit. And Rav Kook, even when he was in Europe, even before he was in Eretz Yisrael, all that he dreamed about was coming to Eretz Yisrael. All that he dreamed about was the fact that Kadosh Baruch Hu obviously created a land to connect to Kadosh Baruch Hu in. And when the position opened up in Yafo, he went to go speak to the Rav Yushalayim of Shmuel Salant. He got permission to become the Rav of Yafo, and became the Rav of Yafo at a very early age, in his 30s, in 1904. And he was very, very effective as the Rav of Yafo. The Rav of Yafo was not just to be the Rav of the community of Yafo, which in itself was a large community, but it's to be a Rav for all the Chalutzim who had come, for all the areas outside of Yafo, to deal with many of the the yeshuvim that had sort of sprouted up. And Rav Kook found himself in a position to really deal with and be metapa with the spectrum of the Jewish community living in Eretz Yisrael. And many difficult, complex issues came up. For instance, issue 1910. Everybody know what happened in 1910? So that obviously is relevant for today. The issue of the Heter Mechira, where Rav Kook decided, or he felt, he was passionate about the fact that at this early stage of the land's development, if we don't institute, if we don't allow for Heter Mechira, saying that already had come into effect from beforehand, it would strangle the yeshuv, it would strangle the community, and he fought battles to make sure the Heter Mechira was put forth. He took a number of rabbanim, including Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld and others, and they would travel from community to community up north and in the Galil, different areas, to try to be mechazek many of the Jewish farmers, the religious farmers, to try to support them in their efforts. He really had a tremendous role as the Rav of Yafo. And unfortunately for him, he had promised that he would never leave Eretz Yisrael. He never wanted to leave Eretz Yisrael. But in 1914, he had to go to speak outside of Israel. He had to go speak in the United States to give support to what was going on in Eretz Israel. And of course, in 1914, very suddenly, the war broke out. And he was stuck for the course of the war for 5 years, both in Switzerland and in England. 1919 comes, the war is over, and there are efforts to bring Rav Kook back to Eretz Israel. And there were many people who were in favor. People like Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, people like Rav Yaakov Moshe Kharlap. Rav Kook had many, many followers. And many people believed that Rav Kook's presence was not desired. People wanted to bring Rav Kook back, not to be the Rav in Yafo, not to go back to Yafo, which the environment in Yafo was perhaps not as quote-unquote religious. It wasn't the center of Eretz Yisrael. But people wanted to bring Rav Kook back to Eretz Yisrael in 1919 after the war to be the Rav in Yushalayim. And let me tell you what met Rav Kook in 1919 when he came, traveled from England to Eretz Yisrael. He came to the Lod, to the train station in Lod, and he was met there by a number of different factions. There was one faction of people from Yafo that came to him. Now, nowadays, it's hard for us to even imagine this, because probably most of you don't even know, if I ask you who the chief rabbi of Israel is. So many of you might say Rabbi Lau, who has not been Rabbi Lau for many years. The relationship with the chief rabbinate, and this is obviously part of the issue, is completely different than it used to be. In general, what's that?
It is Rabbi Lau.
What's that? Well, okay, not Rabbi Lau that you're thinking of, but all right. The relation with the Rabbanim in general, it used to be that a Rav or one of the Gedolim would come to the United States, you would have people lining up by the docks to come meet him, and who's going to have him stay with him, and there was a recognition of personalities in ways that I don't think exists b'zman hazeh. Obviously, a little bit of that was exhibited when Rav Yosef was nifter this past year, but it's very, very rare. Back then, Rav Kook, when he would go to places, he was greeted by the entire community, and the Rav of the community would come out to see him, and the politicians would come out to see him, and these were sort of internationally known personalities, which is amazing considering, again, there was no YouTube videos of Rav Kook, and there wasn't emails, and there weren't proclamations, even his farm were not very well known. And when he came back to Eretz Yisrael in 1919, again, various delegations came out to meet him. You had the delegation, people of Yafo, who remembered him from before the war, right? Come back and be our Rav back in Yafo, and we need you there. And people were literally throwing themselves on the ground to try to get Rav Kook to come back to Yafo. There was the delegation of those people who had come out from Yushalayim. Again, people I mentioned, Rav Yaakov Moshe Kharlap, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, and Rav Nachman Parush, and many, many others. And they said, you have to come to Yushalayim. We need you here. We need your unifying efforts. We need your vision. We need your idealism. It's a different time in Eretz Yisrael, which we'll discuss in a second. And you're the person with your... it's only not modernity, but your ability to connect to the world of where it is now. You're needed in Yushalayim. There was that group as well. They tell the story about Rav Menachem Parush, who was one of the formidable Rabbanim of the time. whereas Rav Kook, as I was about to say in a second, decided that he would go back to Yafo. Rav Nachum Porush, he threw himself down on the road in front of Rav Kook's, I guess, wagon, and said, "We're not going to let them defeat us. You have to come with us." And just as this was going on, Rav Kook received a note from Yerushalayim that many of the Gedolim, I guess with the Eid HaRedis, the more Haredi Rabbanim, they told Rav Kook, "Do not come to Yerushalayim." So you have people who say come to Yafo, people that are throwing themselves at Rav Kook, they come to Yerushalayim. And many others wrote a note and they said that if you come to Yerushalayim, you have to understand how complex the times are here in Yerushalayim. You have to understand what's going on. You have to understand the controversies and the conflicts. He says right away, no one's going to accept you. And the only way that will even sort of allow you to begin that process, if you can assure us right now, which we'll discuss in a second, that you will not remove the ban on secular studies that exist in Yerushalayim for all the students learning there. And this was even just the scene, right? If you think sort of like the Rabundus, you know, is sort of complex, Bizmanenu, this was the scene that Rav Kook was met with, standing in 1919 in Eretz Yisrael when he came back after the war. The question is, what was the issue? Why was Rav Kook such a polarizing personality? Why was he such a figure that brought out such a conflict and those who were so willing to reject him, those who are willing... And the issues really revolved around three or four points, but all of which came from Rav Kook in many ways being a visionary. Rav Kook's depth, Rav Kook's poetic spirit, Rav Kook who in many ways sort of like saw beyond... So with the superficiality of an issue and trying to tap into something beyond that. What were those three or four issues that really were issues of conflict? So issue number one is that Rav Kook believed, and he was a rector for saying this, that there was a need of a total change in the rabbinate. He said people no longer respect Rabbanim. He said Rabbanim are often painted into a corner. They're often affiliated with one political group or others. They often don't understand the times, and therefore the aura and the mystique and the kavod for the Rabbanim have been diminished. And Rav Kook believed, which was a huge issue of conflict, that the only way to bring back the beauty of the rabbinate and the respect of the rabbinate was by establishing a central rabbinate, by establishing a chief rabbinate. Not that everyone had their corner, and everyone was involved in bickering, and everyone was involved in conflict, everyone was involved in issues. There would be a chief rav, one for Ashkenazim, one for Sephardim, that really understood the issues of the day. Their piskei halacha could be geared to the issues of the day. There are people who would work with the government, the politicians, the lay people, and really be people who are connected to the populace. And by establishing a chief rabbinate, that would be the way of bringing back the glory of the rabbinate. And this was something that came under vicious, vicious attack of the chief rabbinate, and really for two reasons. Right? The first reason is probably obvious, maybe it's something that we can even see a little bit today, that we don't want especially when there was such a skepticism, which we'll discuss in a few minutes, about the Zionists and the irreligious Zionists, and Chaim Weizmann wanted the chief rabbinate. And so we don't want the rabbinate to be under the thumb of the government, the politicians, the Zionists, the secularists, that in same way it's going to control exactly any issues dealing with the rabbinate, whether it be on Geiris, whether it be on Kedushin, whether it be on Gittin, whether it be on Kashrus, whether... And you can't have an official body of the rabbinate. That was issue number one. And issue number two is that the chief rabbinate was there as an appeals court. It was there that if there was any issue of any basin throughout Eretz Yisrael, people could then go ahead and bring that psak din to the chief rabbinate, that being appeals court. And that's something also the people were exceedingly negative about. He said that each basin has to function by itself. You can't have someone looking over the corner. And when Rav Kook and others tried to establish in the early 1920s the chief rabbinate, it created even a further divide. People broke off and they established, I'm a loser in Eretz Yisrael, you'll not be surprised by this, because we'll have our own Vad Ha'ir, we'll have our own Eid Haredis, with our own Hechsher, with our own standards, we'll have our own Bate Dinim, we'll have our own this. Rav Kook became the Rav of Yushalayim after a period of time, but we'll have our own Rav, Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, because we're not going to sort of be machshiv this community that in a way seems like it's trying to coalesce in a way with the other forces. And this issue, the Chief Rabbinate, many, many books have been written about, and was an absolutely huge issue in Eretz Yisrael in the early 1920s. There was another issue, if I want to maybe venture another guess, besides the Chief Rabbinate that created incredible animosity. Another issue, but what's that? Okay, so not exactly. Right? I mean, that's sort of a later issue, right? But another issue also, tremendous animosity, tremendous problems, was that Rav Kook felt that education had to have been redone, modernized. He said that there are those people in the world that believe our system of learning should just be the way that it always has been. Sort of in the standard Lithuanian, and Rav Kook, of course, was a product, as I said, of the Volozhin, Gemara, right, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, etc., etc. Okay. And he believed that we're living in an era, said Rav Kook, where that's really not enough. He said, we're living in an era, he said, where the world has changed, where the necessity, where people are curious about the world out there, people who have been are leaving the yeshivas or a certain world in droves. There's an energy in the world, there's a creativity in the world, there are Jews who are interested in a whole array or whole range of learning options. And Rav Kook felt that had to be part of the yeshiva education as well. And obviously the focus is Gemara, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Shulchan Aruch. That obviously has to be the focus. But it's all incorporated into that as well, Hebrew language, which if you know anything, Hebrew language for us, okay, when you say Hebrew language in YU, it's like, okay, which teacher? And you know, the anger is more about, you know, whatever the case may be. I did pass my Hebrew test. But the issue of validating Hebrew language, and Hebrew language being A, the language in Israel, but being studied, modern Hebrew language being studied, obviously that was also a huge issue with Haramim and other things also as well, that Hebrew language should be part of the education, philosophy should be part of education. Rav Kook was a poet. That's not part of the education, but that's part of something as well that can be called Jewish philosophy, Jewish history, more focus on Tanakh. That this was the entirety of Jewish learning, and that the responsibility of the Rabbanim and the Mechanchim is to somehow sort of bring out the holy sparks. And that's a common theme in Rav Kook. The holy sparks, the light of that material, and that should be something that is encouraged for everyone. And a central yeshiva was set up, which of course is now known as Mosad Harav, right? As far as having a central yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. And imagine again that if you're part of the Yeshiva Yeshan, you are the students of the Vilna Gaon, you know, hundreds of years later or 100 years later, imagine what that felt like, sort of this change with Jewish education, moving away from traditional models. That was another thing also became a tremendous source of conflict between the Yeshiva Yeshan and, of course, Rav Kook. And the last issue, and the most major issue, was Rav Kook's perspective towards the entire entity of Zionism. And that obviously is really the centerpiece of this issue. Now, how does the world deal with, how does the community deal with the changes that were taking place over the course, if you're standing in the year 1920, over the course of the last 40 years, of the movement towards Zionism, of thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews who were leaving yeshivas, who were throwing away their yarmulkes. And it wasn't just that it was a-religious, that it was non-religious, but it was specifically anti-religious. There was a feeling that that which had held us down in the ghettos, that which had held us down in Russia and Eastern Europe and throughout other areas, was our clinging on to tradition, our wimpiness, that we couldn't stand up and fight, our lack of strength. And Zionism very much was about a rejection, at least in the early stages, of the old ways, where people were, you know, the old image of the Jew in the shtetl, a rejection of that image and everything that entailed, and then moving forward to Eretz Yisrael, building kibbutzim, fighting. So what do you do if you are the religious community and you see those changes? changes that are really bigger than the yeshiva community, changes that are sweeping between that and Haskalah, sweeping the Jewish community. How do you respond to it? What is the response to those changes? And of course, the response of the Yishuv HaYashan, the response of the old guard, of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, all the people who were in Tzaddik and Gemurim, was to essentially reject it in its entirety, to separate themselves from it, to ensconce themselves in a world away from it, to be very negative towards the Zionist entity, to speak out against it. And Rav Kook believed, and again, this is a much more complicated, much more in-depth, we have time for now, that Rav Kook believed, and this was really where much of the criticism came from, that even though these Zionists were not just a-religious, but anti-religious, in their spirit to build up the land of Israel, in their energy, in their passion, energy and passion that could have been sort of shifted over where they converted to Christianity, says Rav Kook, or they could have gone off and done something not worthwhile. But this energy, this passion, this movement, this great idealism, that there was holiness there. And that was a very controversial idea. There was holiness there, that there was a desire in some way of doing tshuva. There was a desire in the settlers themselves, in the chalutzim themselves, in the Zionists themselves, of to repent and to build and to bring Mashiach. And if only you had the right leadership, and if only we could tap into those passions and that energy and that, so then that is part of the Messianic process. Right? Mashiach will come over the course of time. Eretz Yisrael will be built up in a religious sense over the course of time if somehow those energies, those passions, that idealism, that strength can be harnessed. Rav Kook used to describe, and this is something that people used to obviously be very critical of, how inspired he was when he would see the non-religious Zionists playing soccer. Right? And he would say that the energies that are there, the passions that are there, and that these passions themselves are significant and they're holy. Many other comments like Rav Kook, and he said that specifically, Yemos HaMashiach, and something that drew criticism, was not going to come from the people necessarily in the Beis Medrash, who are studying whether this is treif, whether this is usur, this is mutter. It has to come from people of youth, of energy, of passion, of idealism. And if you build up the structure, even though the structure itself, even though the Zionist entity itself, was something that was anti-religious, if that's built up, that will then reveal the inner sparks of repentance, of tshuva, of kedusha, of Yemos HaMashiach, and that obviously is going to be the beginning of the Yemos HaMashiach. That was Rav Kook's great vision. Now, obviously, that type of vision of essentially embracing, as Rav Kook did, both physically and ideally, ideologically, you know, the settlers and the Zionists, was something that created tremendous animosity, tremendous conflict, a tremendous divide, a tremendous gap between people. And that became really two different schools of thought of how do we view the state of Israel? How do we view Zionism? Do we view Zionism as something that should be embraced in all of its perhaps lack of an ideal state? Should we embrace that entity? Should we say that even though it's something that is foreign from us, there's sanctity there? And that's what Rav Kook believed, and many others who came afterwards and who founded yeshivot and founded maybe yeshuvim, that there's holiness there to harness into, or is something that we reject? Now obviously, I'll conclude in a few moments with this, you know, when this conflict and this argument existed between Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and Rav Kook, they truly loved each other. They spoke about Rav Kook when he came to Eretz Yisrael in 1919. The first place he went to was the house of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, and they embraced. They used to always have a fight when they would go to a bris milah. Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld would tell Rav Kook, no, you're a Kohen, and you're the Rav of the city. You should do the milah. You should do it. And Rav Kook said, no, you're the bigger Talmid Chacham. You should be the Sandeik. Excuse me, not the milah, but the Sandeik. They tell a story about how the two of them, they literally had like a 10-minute fight. No, you should go first, walk through the door. No, you should go first. There was tremendous affection and respect between Rav Kook and really the leaders of the quote-unquote Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael. The problem is that, as we know, that great people can have a discussion on one level over ideas and over passions and over the Torah. But then obviously people that are much smaller minded, people that are not as connected, people that have that elevated spirit, obviously soon the level in which that conflict debate takes place on obviously becomes far diminished. And that's really what happened even in Rav Kook's life and certainly afterwards. There would be posters that go over all over Yerushalayim speaking about Rav Kook as Oso Ha'ish. They wouldn't even name him by name. They would say that man. Oso Ha'ish has probably a double connotation of sorts. There was constant animosity that existed. Rav Kook would walk down the streets and people were yelling at him. Kids would stand outside his window throwing rocks through his window when he was learning the Chavrusa. This was even in his lifetime. But even though Rav Kook and Rav Sonnenfeld himself, this debate over how do we embrace sort of this national spirit existed on one level, even in that same period of time, a year later, and 5 years later, 10 years later, so obviously that became far diminished. I shouldn't even speak about such things, but I went to, and I live in Muncie, where there's farms that are called Tuvias. Tuvias has like a wide range of farm, just even sort of speak about sort of this issue about Rav Kook. And he says, whenever he comes into the store, he always finds Rav Kook's Svarim, someone put it in the bathroom in the store. And he found the kids, and he said, what are you doing? He said, why do you dislike Rav Kook? They have no idea. They have no idea who Rav Kook was. They have no idea about this debate. But unfortunately, debate that exists on a certain dargah, on a certain level, clearly even within a short period of time, and certainly a generation, two, three, four generations later, has led to some of the scenes that I described as far as the flags and burning the flags and things of that nature. You know, it's our hope, certainly my hope, that we view hashkafa, we view idealism, certainly as, or an ideology, certainly as being important, but being a very, very small piece of a larger picture. And my hope is that Jews all over the world, no matter who they are, that what clearly comes to the fore on today and all days is a deep sense of Avodas Yisrael. I mentioned the story, and I'll conclude with this, of Rav Kook, that Rav Kook and Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was the head of the Eidah Charedis, they had to go to a certain meeting together, a certain conference together, and again, the same debate ensued. No, you should go first, you're the rub of the community, you're a Kohen, or you should go first, you're B'Gedam HaChacham. And eventually they're sitting there, and Rav Kook realized as they're going through, as many doors are in Eretz Yisrael, you have like a door, and then there's like a double door, as one door is locked. Rav Kook said, you know what, here's a solution. And he picked up the peg, you know, what the Mishnah Gemara described, and the second door opened, and they walked hand through hand, arm through arm, into wherever they had to go. That should really be the image of where we are in life. And one last thing I should just mention, something about Rav Kook, one of my favorite stories about him. There was a particular personality in Yerushalayim who was one of the leaders of the Eidah Charedis, and he was the person who was most responsible for so much of the negativity about Rav Kook, who put up signs all over Yerushalayim about, again, Oso Ha'ish, and this person's not a real Rav, and let's come, we'll storm his house. And I mean, so this person had a daughter who was sick. And the only person, obviously the hospitals in Eretz Yisrael were not then what they are today. The doctor who could have done the operation was living in England. And he told this person, Hadid Haredis, he says, you know, I'm exceedingly busy. And he says, but I'm very, very close to Rav Kook from his days here. He said, if you can get a letter from Rav Kook about who you are, so then I can, you know, I'll be able to see your daughter here in England. Imagine. So of course, when it comes to your kids, you put all shame aside. And he went to the house of Rav Kook. And he was terrified. And he came in, and Rav Kook gave him a tremendous embrace. And he says, you know, you must be going through so much with your daughter. And he wrote him a letter about this person. This person's a Yorei Shemayim, and this person's passionate. This person really cares about Am Yisrael. This person really... And he sends off the letter, and the guy sort of takes the letter and goes running out of Rav Kook's house. Everyone knows where Rav Kook's house is in Yerushalayim. And just as he was leaving, sort of Arya Levine comes like walking after him. And he said, oh, wait, hold on one second. And this guy probably thought that Rav Kook came to his senses. He wants the letter back. He said, Rav Kook realized, you know, how expensive the trip is. You know, he doesn't have money. So he took, here's another letter. You can get a free trip. And here's whatever money that the Rav had on him. And you should obviously have a refuah shleimah for your daughter. And to me, that image of even in conflict, what it means to be a Gadol B'Yisrael, what it means to be a Kadosh, what it means to have Avodas Yisrael, So all of us should, this is just like a little bit of a glimpse of it, have better understanding of that time period. But even with all of those conflicts, all of those issues, the frustrations, the animosities, that we should all allow ourselves that that beautiful strand of Avos Yisrael, a sense of a united Klal Yisrael comes to the fore, we can have a full appreciation of this day, and hopefully all Klal Yisrael will come back to Eretz Yisrael in the future. Thank you. Yeah.